Hi, my name is Kunal, and welcome to the Geeks of the Valley podcast, which connects with some of the brightest minds globally who are leading their respective industries today to discuss the hottest upcoming industry trends and how their work is affecting the global economy. What started off as a coffee chat has now grown into a global platform for visionaries. This morning from Islamabad, Pakistan, our guest today is a prominent figure in the world of venture capital in Pakistan. He's the founder of Zain Venture Capital, a firm that has been making waves in the startup ecosystem in the region. With his extensive experience in finance, investment, and the global macroeconomic environment, he has been instrumental in helping young entrepreneurs turn their ideas into successful businesses. So without further ado, please give a warm welcome to our guest today, Faisal Aftab. Faisal, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
And how are things with you over there in Pakistan?
It's actually great. It's just another day in a frontier market. We've obviously been through a huge cycle in all emerging and frontier markets. But believe it or not, I actually feel like I actually made this public that I believe the bottom is in for Pakistan. And if you look back in 24 months, this period that we're going through will be the bottom. So more optimistic.
It's good that you brought this up. And with the recent Fed decisions on the Ukraine invasion, how do you see these events playing a role in the Pakistan market and economy?
So it's, I think it's played a huge role. I mean, everything you've seen, everything from the government changing to the system shaking, the economy literally coming to a halt. This cycle is, I think all cycles are somewhat linked to geopolitics, but this cycle is different, as I mentioned, because we lived in a financial system that was relatively predictable from 1980 to 2020, where in 1991, the U.S. became the sole superpower in the world, so which was kind of a good thing for all of us because we had, we knew the rules of the game. So it was a U.S. financial system. We understood the Securities and Exchange Commission, the judicial laws, and so everything was relatively sound. There's a lot of faith in the American system, and so it was easier to navigate those cycles. I think post 2020, we've split from a unipolar world, which is a dominant U.S. Power globally, to a multipolar world, or at least the initial signs of it. And so that changes the paradigm to some extent. And so this particular cycle, I personally think we're in a financial warfare between China, Russia, the U.S. and affiliate allies, because you're seeing countries start to wanting to do currency swaps for trade and de-dollarize to some extent, not to a significant extent. But the reason is because they feel the SWIFT system has been weaponized after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which, by the way, was, is again Russia's insecurity and them getting more aggressive. So I'm not necessarily opposed to the sanctions there. I'm just highlighting how the world is fracturing along the geopolitical lines. And so for Pakistan, what effectively happened is with high rates, I mean, we saw 100%, 150% currency devaluation, just like we did in actually multiple other currency countries like Egypt and Turkey and Iran. But Pakistan and Egypt are a little bit, they feel it more aggressively because typically when there's a rate hike, which means the U.S. is pulling liquidity out of the system and the dollar gets stronger, countries that are net importers of commodities, specifically energy, tend to feel it the hardest. And so these cycles are fairly predictable if you plot them on a map, and so are the Fed cycles. I mean, in terms of, you can't really time it, but you do know, once 7-8 years of a low interest rate environment kicks in, the chances are we're going to, jack rates. This next 10 years is going to be a little bit more different, where I think we're going to have multiple rate hikes and rate cuts. So it'll be interesting. But for Pakistan, really watching rate hikes and then helping startups navigate the periods of low liquidity and periods of abundant liquidity, which is low interest rates, is how you have to help scale a country. So a little bit different, scale a company. So a little bit different than Silicon Valley. I hope that answered your question. It's a bit of a long-winded response, but it's a complicated country to invest in.
Earlier in the conversation, you alluded to the geopolitical situation. And when it comes to the impact on Pakistan's economy, what are some factors that investors should potentially consider when investing in the country?
Yeah, so again, and I was alluding to that 1980 to 2020 lens, right? So again, and as we move to a multipolar world, using simply quantitative analysis that we could have done from 1980 to 2020, which a lot of hedge funds have done in the past, and I think a lot of VC funds underlying also do that when doing the country analysis. I think that environment has changed, and geopolitics actually is at the core now of what's driving finance and investments and acquisitions of companies, because we really are in the American digital empire versus the Chinese digital empire era. And obviously there's other players out there, but these are the two most dominant tech players in the world. And case in point would be, if you look at the S&P 500, you know, 20 years ago, you barely had, you know, any of the big tech companies in the top 10, apart from Microsoft. Today, you see, if you see the collective market cap of S&P, the five or six big tech companies, the FAMs or the NAMs, now effectively dominate. So that pretty much tells you we migrated from the industrial age to the digital age. So investing in a country like Pakistan's, you know, you have to keep these fissures in mind. We are somewhere in the middle of China and the US. Historically, we've been a US ally. And China has always been a friend to Pakistan. But I would say since 2005, when US did an outreach towards India in terms of a strategic partnership, Pakistan has tilted, at least from a military supply lines perspective, more towards China. And so if you look at the first acquisition in Pakistan that happened, that was Alibaba moving in and acquiring Daraz, which is one of the largest e-commerce, is the largest e-commerce platform in Pakistan. Similarly, you saw Ant Financial move in and take a stake in EasyPesa, very similar to M-Pesa. It was owned by Telenor, but similar to M-Pesa in Africa. So, you know, initially we saw the Chinese get more aggressive, which incidentally was the exact same thing that played out in India when they were going through their first, second wave in 2010 and 11, where a lot of Chinese investors moved in and created platforms like Paytm. And then subsequently, once India had a stronger strategic partnership with the US, you saw American platforms pummel in and pile in to beat the Chinese platforms, which would be, for example, in payments, Ambani's Jio payment platform. So you have to kind of watch out those similar things in Pakistan. I personally think Pakistan is somewhere in the middle. We're more affiliated with the Gulf states, the GCC countries like Saudi and UAE. And they tend to, you know, they tend to be in the middle where they have a deep affiliation with the US, but they also want to trade with the Chinese for as buyers of energy going forward. So I think we're going to have a lot of the American investments or American platforms enter Pakistan via Gulf state company acquisitions. So case in point would be Souq.com getting bought out by Amazon, and then Amazon looking to make a foray into Pakistan via their understanding of the region from the Gulf acquisitions. So these things become, to me, geopolitics is extremely tied to what's happening. And again, if you look at what's happening in Taiwan and the supply chain, US moving the semiconductor supply chain somewhere back home, is concerned about Taiwan, but at the same time, they're also moving supply chains for Apple and other tech companies to India, where they have a stronger alliance, is kind of alluding to some of what I'm saying. So very important to keep geopolitics in mind.
And speaking of how you believe a lot of the Western investments are going to come through, you know, GCC into Pakistan, as a venture investor in the ecosystem, what are some trends or opportunities that you're currently seeing in the current market?
So everybody's seeing different opportunities. I'm more thesis driven. Pakistan's a very interesting opportunity where, you know, the entire tech ecosystem was delayed primarily, not necessarily because of a shortage of resource. We're mini India in terms of the talent and tech resources, and even expats that are fairly, you know, they're fairly senior. And if you look at Silicon Valley or the finance sector in the US or London, you'll see Pakistanis at everywhere from BlackRock to Blackstone to Google to Facebook. So we have that footprint just like India. The I think what really was the catalyst, and this was part of our thesis when I was doing our investment deck to explain why the opportunities now. If you look at the region, 3G and 4G was launched in 2006 and 10 or 11. If you look at India, for example, and the rest of the region. In Pakistan, the first auctioning of the license didn't take place till about 2013, 14. And so 3G and 4G really started coming into play around 50, which is in frontier markets like Pakistan, most people cannot afford laptops and desktops. So smartphones is the way to connect. And so it's very important to have 3G and 4G. So that played out. And so now with the lag effect, you've got critical mass. You have almost like 80 to 60, 80 million plus smartphone users or data users. And it's growing as one of the fastest adoption rates in the world. So it's a huge opportunity from that perspective. So what I'm looking at in Pakistan, so the reason why I'm mentioning all this is that, traditionally you have e-commerce happens, then you have mobility happening, logistics happening, and then you have fintech and AI and robotics, I mean, in different stages, right? In Pakistan, because of that lack of critical mass and a lack of investments, because we see venture capital funds need a critical mass of data users, that all kind of culminated in 2020 to in Pakistan. And so, I'm looking, the bulk of our portfolio, 50 to 60% is in fintech. And we're looking at primarily B2B fintech today. The reason why we do have one B2C fintech, but that's a very gated opportunity in terms of data, where it's coming from transaction history of the big 10 of the biggest banks in Pakistan. And so they've been able to lend with minimal losses. But if you go straight to the consumer, it's a slippery slope because your NPLs can skyrocket very quickly because you haven't had the historical data points on users to make informed decisions. And that's primarily because, for example, if you look at our portfolio, I've done about 5 B2C e-commerce investments, and they're all scaling pretty rapidly. In the rest of the world, this opportunity is gone. And that's in the travel space, that's in the grocery space, that's in the beauty and personal fashion space. So we've kind of hit that particular element, and that's gathering one element of the data and scaling the marketing and getting consumer data. Then we've done B2B investments, companies like Bazaar, very similar to Udaan in India. We've done Zerai, which is like off business, raw materials marketplace. And then we've done the rest of all fintech, which are basically everything from supply chain fintechs, settlement infrastructure layer to your payment wallets that are again infrastructure layer, to point of sale systems, infrastructure layer, and then companies like Abhi and Adelphi and Postex. Postex is actually logistics fintech. And then also Truck It In, which is basically the freight, long distance freight. So we've invested across the board. And the thesis is that today, that basically ultimately I view everything from the perspective that, this is kind of everything is a fintech. And because I believe we're in the exchange of value disruption, and which at the protocol level is, people call it cryptocurrencies or Bitcoin and Ethereum, and we can dive into that later. But when you look at everything from that lens and how KYC, AML, CFT and lending and velocity of money is going to play out, then it starts to make sense why you're building a portfolio and aggregating this type of data. And going forward, I think the opportunity is only going to amplify in Pakistan in more of the fintech element as all these platforms in B2C, B2B continue to scale and gather data, and then they just feed this data to fintech. This country is about 250 million people. The documented economy, in my opinion, is barely one third. So officially it's 350 billion. It's really a $1 trillion economy. And that documentation, just like what we saw in India from 2016 to 2020, is going to come from adoption of digital payments. So it's a pretty predictable pattern when you see the lag effects between India and Pakistan and similar cultures.
Taking a turn in the conversation, you expressed a bullishness on Bitcoin. Can you elaborate on your thoughts and share your perspective on the future of crypto?
Yeah, so what I just alluded to, I'm investing in Pakistan because of crypto. So we're in, if you look at blockchain and AI together, then it makes sense that, whether it's 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, the world will be cashless in nature. And as I mentioned in my response to your previous question as part of our thesis, these next 11 countries and the next billion users, these users are primarily, these are black economies or informal economies. So the documentation level in these countries has been very low in terms of getting data and users being financialized and part of the banking system. So blockchain technology or the protocols, which whether you want to call Bitcoin or Ethereum and iterations of it, I tend to look at it more from the Bitcoin and Ethereum lens because Bitcoin to me is a commodity and Ethereum is potentially a security. I mean, the way it's structured, it could be a commodity as well. but they're two separate things. So for me, crypto, I don't look at it from a like it's some sort of revolution or libertarian dream. It is technically a libertarian dream, but I don't think that's what it is. It's more of a macro event that's happening. So I'm bullish on Bitcoin because the space and point in time where we are today is resembles a lot of 1931, 1932, where you're in a monetary transition, where this thing is, we are going to have a new monetary system, whether it takes 10 years, 20 years, 15 years. And I do believe it's going to be a digital settlement versus, as I alluded to, the SWIFT system, which is the analog settlement system. Now, in that cashless environment that may exist in 10 years, 20 years, you're going to need an asset of last resort similar to gold. And so I'm bullish on Bitcoin because I think it's digital gold, and the algorithm has been designed with proof of work to actually be more scarce than gold. And typically at times like this, when you have a multipolar world challenging each other on currencies, there is always a hedge with gold. So case in point would be Russia declaring a gold standard last year, the second it invaded Ukraine. If you go look at the ruble charts, ruble was tanking once the second they got sanctions. And then once they did a gold peg, I think it was 5,000 grams to a ruble, they had a V-shaped recovery of the ruble within 2 weeks. So gold is going to play a role, but I think Bitcoin is going to play a bigger role. And I do think a lot of institutional investors, so let's say, for example, I'll give you some numbers behind it, why I'm bullish mathematically, right? I think the collective number out there of total investments, whether it's stocks, bonds, real estate, commercial real estate, derivatives, roughly somewhere around $200 to $300 trillion. The total market cap of gold today is around $10 trillion. Is projected by traditional conservative family offices that gold should double over the next 5 years as we continue to print money. So that would mean that gold should go to 20 trillion. Now, in a time like this, you should at least position yourself with 2 to 3% gold, or roughly maybe, I believe it should be closer to 10. That's my personal position, 10%. But let's just apply that same, replace gold with Bitcoin. And so that's what I've done. I believe that if you have 10% of those assets move into gold or Bitcoin, I don't think they're going to move into gold, because if they do, we will have World War III. So they'll probably end up moving into Bitcoin, especially the US institutional money. So that would put us at a market cap of anywhere from 10 trillion to 15 trillion. And then that kind of gives that Moon Boys those numbers of like 100,000 plus. I don't think Bitcoin goes to $1 million in like 2 years. But I do think that $100,000 is possible in the next 3 years, or longer, or even 200,000 based on the market cap scenarios that I've told you. And that obviously the underlying assumption, the big one here, is that the Fed is going to be cutting again, which I believe is a mathematical certainty, given how over-leveraged the system is. So I believe they're going to cut sometime in 2024, when there's a credit event. And that's going to obviously create the next spike in Bitcoin. That started right now, but this is just wave one. We'll probably see a secondary dip, and then we'll see potentially a little bit of a higher high than we saw last time. So that's why I'm bullish on Bitcoin and obviously Ethereum as well.
So to this point, recently the SEC hasn't been, too supportive of the crypto Web3 industry. And how much of a role do you think they will play in the coming years? And what impact do you think they'll have when it comes to the overall investment landscape, for emerging technology?
So it's especially specifically blockchain crypto. It is the SEC, I would say, in fact, more than the SEC, I would say regulation is the most important component. If we're going to truly get to that 100,000 and above, like Tim Draper's 250,000, which by the way is pretty well thought out thesis, is just the timing. Nobody can time the market perfectly. You need regulation, and the reason why I mentioned, if you in my previous response, was I mentioned, the total market cap of assets out there, invested assets, is roughly around $200-300 trillion, right? So you need to get like a percentage of that into Bitcoin as digital gold, or overall the crypto market. So in order for that to happen, it's going to mostly be institutional capital. They're not going to feel comfortable investing in Bitcoin or Ethereum and other cryptos unless they have clarity, regulatory clarity. So let me kind of backtrack and explain what's happening. So the battle is between the SEC and the CFTC. So one is the Securities and Exchange Commission. The other one is the regulator of commodities. And so in Bitcoin's case, your CFTC thinks they should regulate it because Bitcoin behaves more like a commodity. Whereas, you know, anything that was an ICO, so even though Ethereum kind of is in the middle somewhere because of the change that they've done, but the reality is that the way they were offered in the market was through an initial coin offering, which basically emulates an IPO. And the Securities and Exchange Commission feels that you know, they have a right to regulate this. And obviously there's some, you know, concerns regarding how the ICOs happened in history. So the question is the SEC going to come down and crack hard? So if I was a hedge fund manager, maybe for my like opportunistic pool, I'll take a little bit of a bet on Bitcoin and Ethereum. But if I'm not going to be able to deploy my, you know, 25% of my fund, which in my opinion is not necessarily dumb, that's actually a great bet if you have a long-term 3-4 year view, into Bitcoin and Ethereum, or even if I've done analysis in some of the other cryptos, unless I get that regulatory clarity. So the SEC, and let's go to the SEC, for example, right? Obviously, we've had some developments recently in the last 3-4 weeks with BlackRock, the largest financial institution in the world, putting in an ETF. And if you actually look at the SEC, when they didn't reject the ETF, they actually sent it back with some comments. And what they were saying was that they actually asked all the applicants that, hey, by the way, how are you ensuring that there's no trading manipulation? What is the surveillance technology? And I've been actually a huge advocate that Coinbase is a very, very stable exchange, because if you look at the money in the back end that's come, it's actually the old financial system that has been backing Coinbase. So Digital Currency Group, New York Life, MasterCard, a lot of those investors were there early on in Coinbase before the IPO. So all of them have selected Coinbase as that trusted entity that's going to do the surveillance technology. That's important, obviously, because an ETF is going to be listed on the Intercontinental Exchange to be offered to institutional investors, and they need that certainty. So I do think this ETF will be approved eventually. And when that does, that's what's going to unlock those trillions of dollars coming into Bitcoin, because they're not going to physically buy Bitcoin and hold it in like your Ledger Nano. They need to have it in a custodian, or vehicle like an ETF, to actually play that equation. So that's extremely important. And then obviously the CFTC is going to play its own role. What I'm going to say is, you know, and a lot of the crypto people will hate me for saying this, but I've been in crypto from very early on. I've been there in crypto since 2015, 16. So it's an industry that I know very personally well, and my own net worth has grown because of crypto. But the reality is that it's 2021 was a dot-com moment for crypto. A lot of the cryptocurrencies do not have a use case. A lot of them, the way they're managed in the back end, how they were offered to the market, was very dubious. And I do think when the SEC comes out with the regulation, a lot of the projects that people are betting on, they're going to end up losing their money. So I do think that this cycle, you have to be a little bit careful. Some of the hints you can take is Gary Gensler, in terms of what he said in 2018. He identified in a statement that Bitcoin, Ethereum, Litecoin, and Bitcoin Cash are probably not basic securities. So that should give you a hint of what their thought process is. Also, if you look at the cases that they filed against Coinbase and Binance recently, the Securities and Exchange Commission, they alluded to Bitcoin and Ethereum as probably not being securities. So they've definitely dropped hints out there. So this is not financial advice, but given how important regulation is and how much of a panic can cause, I would be very careful in this cycle. It's going to be a little bit different. So, but I'm very bullish on crypto, by the way, as bullish as I am on Pakistan. If you're asking me, the two most undervalued assets on the planet right now are Bitcoin and Pakistan. Pakistan being the fifth largest country in the world, population-wise, and having effectively, I would say, an 80% undocumented economy, which once we move to digital payments and cashless systems, it's going to leapfrog. Just like India jumped to the fifth largest economy in the world relatively quickly, that was all digital payments. Same thing is going to play out here. And Bitcoin, obviously, because I think central banks are going to print like there's no tomorrow. And even if they hike rates again in 2026, 2027, eventually, there's no other path to print out of this. So that obviously has to be absorbed either by gold, which means World War III, or by Bitcoin and other cryptos, which then means we have a whole digital age. I will leave you lastly with this thought. we're moving from a trust-based world, which is what we've been operating on the internet, where data was somewhat trusted and it basically, but you weren't sure of the accuracy, to a truth-based world where data will be pretty much 100% accurate. It'll be, you will know it's accurate because that's what blockchain does. It'll bring the accuracy on data. And then that's what's going to allow AI to thrive, because AI in the current data sets is going to really struggle unless it's gated and sifted. But once we have that back-end validation, then there's exponential growth this decade. And I'm pretty excited about that.
And Faisal, to wrap up our call with our last question for the day, for listeners out there who are interested in catching a cup of coffee with you or connecting with you over the local startup ecosystem, what would be the best point of contact?
So I would say the best way to reach out is via LinkedIn, because we do check our LinkedIn accounts, or through a warm introduction. We do get inundated a lot, by founders in Pakistan and the local ecosystem. But, you know, generally, if like when you find even a second or third degree person to do a warm introduction, we always then try to respond a lot quicker, just because familiarity is helpful. And then we do go through our LinkedIn and our emails to go through, but obviously we do get inundated there, so the response is a little slower.
Faisal, it was a pleasure having you on Geeks of the Valley, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. A lot of fun. Thanks.